The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. At the end of 3 weeks of party conferences, what trace has been left by all those warm words? In the midst of the worst financial crisis ever, did our politicians turn up any real new ideas? And even if not, can we at least give them some points for releasing their hot air with gusto? Joining me in the studio is a leading professional speechwriter, Simon Lancaster, as well as The Guardian columnists Polly Toynbee and Martin Kettle. A warm welcome to you all. Now, Martin, these conferences come around every year and you're a regular attendee, but I read in this morning's paper that you're not too fond of them.
Well, I think that this year's conferences have exposed the almost sleazy nature of the conference circuit these days. I mean, there are fewer and fewer members of political parties attending, and that's true in all of the parties. There were, for the first time in living memory, quite large blocks of empty seats at David Cameron's speech and at Nick Clegg's. I didn't go into Ed Miliband, so I can't be an eyewitness to that. And their place is taken by the huge numbers of lobbyists, activists on single-issue causes, and, of course, journalists. I mean, we outnumber the people who are there supposedly to confer by a very significant degree. And I just think it's all become a bit pointless because, you know, conferences don't decide anything. They are shop windows. And I think we should think of the people who attend them as the audiences rather than the members or the delegates.
What do you think, Polly? You've done the circuit as well?
Yep, for many a long year, and awful they are, particularly as the press are particularly jaundiced because we are kept on the whole in underground car parks, and particularly bad in Liverpool where we didn't even have telephones that worked, which was taking us back to a prehistoric age. But they are frightful in every kind of way, and as Martin says, he's quite right about them being jam-packed with lobbyists. I did a whole lot of fringe meetings, and I would then ask, particularly for charities of one kind or other, who here is from the voluntary sector? And almost everybody in the room put their hands up. And then you realise they're all paying a fortune to be there from their charities in order to try and lobby. Well, who? Because there aren't any party members who bother turning up at these fringes. So they're all talking to each other on child poverty or green issues or whatever. Fantastic waste of money. I think the Charity Commission perhaps ought to have a look at it.
It's funny. I mean, I did one on vocational education and skills, which sounded very worthy. But then because everyone has to give their name when they ask a question and where are you from? And it was all like the learning together in the Big Society Institute, or that they were all paid to be there. And I did find myself thinking, if we're interested in education, shouldn't they be teaching something instead rather than coming here to talk to each other? Well, the centre point of all the conferences is obviously the big speech. So if we're going to be rude, as we have been, about everything that surrounds that, Simon Lancaster, maybe you can say a bit for us about what you made of the standard of the speeches by Miliband, Clegg and Cameron that we heard this year. Good year? Bad year?
Well, I thought it was a pretty good year. I've just got to come in on Martin's points, if I may, because I think it comes back to a fundamental question that determines the kind of speech that the leaders make, and that's whether or not the conference is for the audience in the room or for the audience at home. And when, you know, party conferences first started out, it was very much about doing it face-to-face, and it was the report back from the parliamentary party to the grassroots. And I think the view has now been made that these conferences are actually more about communicating with the public, which is why it's absolutely right that the media has a larger turnout at these things, because that's the interface that they use to communicate with the public. And I think you see this coming across it in the speeches that, you know, I've got a great stat, which is that the average sentence in each of the leaders' speeches this year was about 10 words. And this has come down from about 20 words a sentence in the 70s and way back to 30 words a sentence in, you know, the 50s. And so this is absolutely right. The speeches are constructed far more now for the media age. But overall, I think this was a pretty good year. Just thinking about the speeches in particular, I think this was a pretty good year. I think Miliband is better than Brown. I think Clegg is better than Campbell. And I think Cameron is better than Howard. I thought there were some nice sound bites. There were some pretty good jokes as far as political jokes go. And I thought where they were weak, there was some sloppy drafting, some poor words that shouldn't have been used. You know, who on earth told Ed Miliband to use the word bargain, which conjures up connotations of 2-for-1 at Tesco's. Who told Nick Clegg that he should keep hammering on about how everything that he's been doing over the last year and a half was right? I think, you know, the drift to the right is precisely what the people in the room are most horrified about. And, you know, even some of Cameron, who's normally quite careful about this, Cameron's drafting on credit card was just sloppy and careless, I thought.
It certainly was, wasn't it? That kind of overshadowed the reception of the speech quite significantly, didn't
Absolutely.
It?
I think it's what this conference season, if it's remembered for anything, or remembered for two things. One, Miliband's attempt to say something quite brave and different, even if he didn't phrase it terribly well. But I think really the insight into the depth of Cameron's economic insouciance. I mean, he has spent all summer on and off working on this speech. He has talked about it at great length with George Osborne. They've gone over it. They've gone over the theme of debt and paying back debt. This wasn't a bad piece of wording. This wasn't an ineptitude that could have been misunderstood. This was a fundamental economic disaster. The idea that the Prime Minister of a country at a time like this, and this week particularly, as he stood up on the stage with the worst possible figures pouring out, should tell everybody to pay off their debts. And within, you know, minutes, the retail organisations, business organisations were tearing their hair out. It was quite alarming insight, I think, into how something that they thought would sound good and down home with the people was more important than the real crisis that we're in.
And Martin, do you think that the Cameron speech will be remembered for that, or do you think it's a storm in a teacup?
I think it's almost forgotten now. I think, actually, I rather agree that the standard of the speeches that by the leaders this year has been quite interesting, quite reasonably high. I mean, I think that Nick Clegg made a serious argument in his speech. One may, you can agree with it or disagree with it, but his argument was that government in a coalition, when you're the minority party in a coalition, is not easy, but worth pursuing. And that's a big message to the Liberal Democrats. And one of the reasons that I liked Clegg's speech quite a lot was I thought it was a speech that was directed to the people in the hall. You know, it was an argument to the party. You know, it was saying, you know, this party's got to grow up, as it were, and recognise what is involved in government. And that, I think, is quite a classic party conference tactic. Miliband's speech, I also thought, was very interesting. And, you know, I think it will be remembered precisely because he tried to get away from the consensus and to reframe the political economic argument in a new way. The new bargain may or may not be the right phrase for it, but, you know, it was pretty clear that he was trying to reshape the argument, and that was a serious thing to do. The trouble with that was that it wasn't addressed to the party in the hall, and I think his problem was that he didn't pick up on the booing of Tony Blair. He wasn't sufficiently aware of the party. He was trying to, you know, schmooze his party rather than to conduct a serious argument with it. And I think that is a problem Labour has still got. Cameron's speech, I thought, was the worst of all because I thought it didn't have an overarching argument to it, other than that, you know, David Cameron is a telegenic and effective communicator.
What was it, leadership just, for tough times or something?
I've already forgotten.
For a better future. Leadership
one of those
for
things,
a better future. Can I ask Simon something? When you construct a speech, I mean, there you are, experienced speechwriter. In the end, we had to sit through an hour of this stuff. Most of it is pretty platitudinous. In the end, all that gets out there is maybe 3 20-second clips plus the crucial 2 minutes of Nick Robinson's analysis of it instant afterwards. And that's all most people are going to see of it. And that's quite a scary thought, really, that this thing that has been constructed costs, with so many people's pens added to it and so much agonising and looking for jokes and looking for this and that, and in the end that's all you get. How do you write a speech that's going to be treated that way?
How do you get up in the morning?
I think after all of that, I am going to look for a change in career, actually. you get your rewards where you can, Polly. I think, you know.
No, I meant how do you construct it? I didn't mean how do you live with yourself. You know, if you know that there are going to be three clips and you have to, and they mustn't just be clever clips, they've got to actually convey whatever the message is.
The key thing is really getting deep into the heart and soul of the person who's speaking and making sure that you get them to think that the speech is important. And I did think that, you know, Ed Miliband had come up with something really interesting there. And I thought his team must have really dug about there to get that out, because it didn't feel like a compromised speech to me, which I think Cameron's maybe did. Mm. Cameron's was, you know, it was very Tory in some places. And, you know, these were the bits that got the big applause when, you know, he was slagging off the EU and stuff like that. But then he also did the vintage Cameron about gay marriage. And I thought with Ed, it did feel to me like a lurch to the left, the speech did. And I thought, you know, when I was watching it, I thought this is the bravest speech that I've seen a Labour leader give in more than 30 years. It's anti-media, it's anti-capital, it's anti-establishment, you know, and this is the kind of stuff that is really going to ring with the audience in the room. I actually thought it was playing to the gallery a bit. And I thought Ed's big problem, actually more than the content of his speech, I thought his speechwriters, with the exception of the word bargain, should have been pretty proud of the job that they did with that. I thought it was let down by his performance. I think the words in there were actually full of empathy, and yet the way he delivered, he feels strangely detached from the audience. I always think he seems a bit like Louis Theroux, that kind of, how did I wind up here? Or, you know.
Which is odd because, you know, Ed Miliband, I think, you know, we've all known him for quite a long time, and we know that the speech that he gave expressed what he believes, and it's the speech that he wanted to give, and it expressed his views quite well. So in that sense, he was in a very happy position, and that's not, as you say, I mean, that's not really what a conference speech often is. He won't have that chance very often, and I thought he took it rather impressively in that sense, but. You know, just to come back, you see, I think that, you know, Polly's point is right, but it comes back to what I was saying at the beginning, in my view, that an inordinate amount of time and effort goes into these speeches. You know, people worry about them for 3 or 4 months at least, if not a bit more. You know, they're seriously time-consuming exercises over the summer when people perhaps should be doing much less.
Or just recharging their batteries.
Recharging their batteries, absolutely. And then in the period of the leading up to the conference, they become quite manic. Now, is this a good thing for politicians? I mean, especially when they haven't actually got all that much to say.
I think
that politicians should, you know, if they want to say something, they should prepare a speech and say it. The problem is that the ritual controls them, and they have to produce a 45 to 60 minute long speech, which very often, you know, has to touch absolutely every single policy area.
Yes, you they
know,
get told I mean, off. Oh, we've nothing on defence.
You know, Cameron had nothing on agriculture.
Let me
terrible.
Let me ask you something, Martin.
What's in your column
today, you were also very scathing about question and answer sessions, because most of these, as you say, are very manicured. You are very safe questioners. If they had, if they genuinely opened it up to questions that they didn't know what they were going to be, and came from genuine members, a lot of them might still be patsy questions. I think that leaders are at their best when they are put on their mettle a bit or don't know what's quite coming. And maybe you just get eccentric questions, not necessarily hostile ones, and you see them having to think on the hoof. I think that's worth doing, and they should abandon speeches in favour of question and answers that were genuine.
Yeah, I'm not against that. But, I mean, my broader point is that this all uses up time in the conference, which in the past used to belong to the floor and to the party. And because parties are hollowed out organisations that don't really exist anymore except as election machines, they no longer are able to do that. And I think that is, I regret that, but it's not going to come back. The toothpaste is well and truly out of the tube.
The Conservative conference in particular, with these extraordinary long scripted questions in inverted commas, which were actually little speeches about how good everything was in a kind of pebble mill type studio setting. I mean, it was
and
so
how
far
is the
from a debate.
Beetroot crop, oh leader, this year?
Yeah, I mean, but isn't that interesting? You know, we remember Conservative Party conferences about which we were all scathing,
yeah,
because they were controlled and manipulated, and they never really came to a decision or had a proper argument. And yet those conferences, in retrospect, were actually quite fibrous and meaty. I mean, they
calling for hanging of Douglas Hurd.
Well, the Tory Party used to invite all of its associations to submit motions, and so there used to be a collection of the motions put forward by all the local organisations. That's all gone now. There's none of that. When you came to the debate, and of course, most famously, this is true in the law and order debates of the 1970s and 80s, you know, there was a motion and people got up from the floor and made impassioned speeches. More recently, that's happened on Europe. And there were big arguments. I mean, there wasn't a vote that mattered necessarily, and it didn't bind anybody, but it was a real conference, grassroots kind of argument. None of that happens now. I mean, I cannot remember the last time that a delegate from the Tory Party stood up and made a controversial speech which the leadership disagreed with.
Because you do feel that parties need to come together. They have some technical things they have to do. But, I mean, actually, in the Labour Party, one, some quite important party political changes, like Ed Miliband being able to choose his own shadow cabinet, which he's doing right now as we speak.
And failing also to get control of the bloc vote again. I mean,
That's true.
He had to make some pretty shaming compromises. It was not a good week for him in that respect.
If we abolish them, though, and the party never met together, I mean, that seems a bit depressing too, because party members having quite a lot of fun meeting each other, those who can afford the whatever it's £750 for the whole week.
Yeah, Conservative Home said it was £700 and something to go to the Tory conference this year, which is just shocking. I mean, yes, you're right. There should be ways of having proper democratic decision making. I mean, yeah, I'm in favour of all that, but it's not what we do anymore. We don't live in a political culture where genuine grassroots people are happy to be represented by people who then have arguments and take decisions. The new media age is all about empowering everybody's view as being as interesting or as relevant as anybody else's. And we've lost that faith in representative democracies. And it's not going to come back, or at least if it does come back, it'll be in long past our lifetimes in circumstances which are at this moment unforeseeable.
So where we are. But Simon, I think you've been saying, if I remember what you wrote rightly, that people despair of the fact that there's no British Obama, but it's as much Britain's fault as the politicians' fault that they have to be less than exciting. Is that right?
Well, I think as we have this national tendency to do ourselves down on kind of all issues, and I was chatting to a professor of rhetoric at a language conference a year or so ago, and I said to him, do you think Yes We Can would ever work over here? And he kind of spluttered his tea all over the place and said, absolutely not. I asked him what could work, and he said, no, we can't would probably go down better. And I do think that's right, that we're, you know, and so, you know, it's easy to think that this has been a dreadful spell of conferences. But in actual fact, I think if you just stand back a bit and resist the temptation to get drawn into that argument, it's not been so bad. I do think Labour is, as a case in point, proves why these conferences are useful, because I think we are now far clearer about where Ed Miliband stands. I think he's been limping along a bit and coming out with empathetic noises over the last year or so. And I think we're now very clear where he is within the party. I don't think Gordon Brown necessarily ran the best kind of Labour conferences. I think his speeches try to be all things to all people. And so you were like, well, what does he really mean about the health service after that? What does he really mean about academies? You were never quite clear. And I think Ed set out a very clear position on these things now. And that's good. And that message has got through to the party. It's got through to the country. You know, I think the trouble has actually come in some of the post-briefing afterwards, where he's been denying it was a lurch to the left. Should he think he should have come out proudly and said, absolutely.
Well, to the left from where? It all depends where people think the centre ground is. And the idea that the centre ground is a fixed spot, or even that we know quite where it is, the centre ground shifts around, particularly on this issue. And then as we now face what the Governor of the Bank of England has called, you know, the worst crisis ever, a very dark winter indeed, he's positioned himself quite well to have something to say about it. And I think where he stands on this, according to all of the polls on this issue, is very much where the people stand. They are very angry with banks. They are very angry with the sort of dysfunctional capitalism that allows the Southern Cross now busy. The idea that this was somehow wild off the wall stuff, he wasn't being anti-capitalist. He was, you know, the Will Hutton view of let's have good capitalism properly regulated.
The thing that I thought was most interesting and slightly in defence of this year's party conference season is that you did get a sense of a moving centre ground on quite a few issues around responsible capitalism. So it was there, Martin, very much in Vince Cable's speech, as well as the defence of cutting the deficit. And there were tiny echoes of it, even in what George Osborne had to say. And so do you think there's a sense that there is some substance here about, you know, there's a new appetite for this kind of not just capitalism, but what kind of capitalism in all three conferences?
Well, I think there is. I think all parties are trying to answer the same question in their different ways, you know, which is how do you moderate and manage the markets, and how do you do this in ways which protects people? You can call it responsible capitalism or a better capitalism or a whatever you want to call it.
Stakeholder capitalism.
Yeah, it's a serious question, a very important question. It's the question of our times in many respects. I think that part of the problem this year is that, for two reasons, I think the party conferences are all, and the parties and party politics in a sense, is a bit on hold. And there are two reasons for that. One, I think, is the simple thing of the fixed term parliament, that because we know there isn't going to be an election until 2015, I mean, there might be, but we are working on that assumption, you know, we're still quite a long way from the dividing lines and basic kind of battle plans for that election. So, you know, we're waiting. You know, it's just too early to kind of have that, those arguments. The second thing is what Polly says, that, you know, because the situation is so, the economic situation is so dire and difficult and serious, people are in a sense, you know, they know the storm is going to come and they know it's going to be bad. And the question is, what do we do at the end of it? So I think that in a sense, politics is slightly kind of like the trench warfare of the First World War at the moment. It's sort of stuck. It's not a politics of movement. It's where it is.
I wouldn't count on it. I think that it's yet to be interpreted what's going on, and I think it depends how long it goes on for, how bad it is, how many people feel really hit by it. I mean, it could go in all sorts of ways. I couldn't predict. But I don't think it's just going to be sort of static and then back to how we were, but a bit poorer.
No, I'm not saying that. No, I agree. I've never said, I'm not at all saying it will be back to that. And, you know, thank goodness it's, you know, the storm's over and now we can head off again and have stupid financial instruments and all that. It's not going to be like that. I completely agree. But I think we are at a point where people are not taking risks economically, and they're not taking risks politically, because it's a difficult time to foresee. It's difficult to foresee. That's all I'm saying.
Can I just lighten this somber mood for a moment by asking Simon about the role of jokes in speeches? The lucky listener in a moment is going to hear a selection of some of the classic material that we heard churned out this year. When you sit there and write a speech for someone, do you write in jokes always, or does it depend on who the speaker is? What do you think?
It depends very much on the speaker. Some people can deliver a gag and other people just can't. And, you know, when I was writing speeches for the cabinet, I was writing speeches for Alan Johnson. He was brilliant at coming up with gags. He'd always come up with the best ones himself.
You wouldn't write them in?
I would suggest some, and some of them he'd even use. Most of them he said, this is far too obscene, or, you know, something like that. But I certainly used to try. But I thought this year's gags were actually pretty good. I counted them. It was curious that they all came up with 8 jokes. All of the 3 leaders had 8 jokes.
It's the ration.
It's the ration. Not allowed more than 8.
Any more than that would be outrageous.
I think some of those must have passed me by. Were they really jokes?
They were kind of, they generated laughs. That was it. that was my criteria. I thought Cameron's were probably best because he managed to diffuse some of the tensions of the week by, you know, because that's what you do with the joke. You take something that's got too big and then you kind of puncture it. And he did that.
This economy thing, all a bit out of hand.
Well, a classic of those was that one that Blair used about Brown, wasn't
it? Oh, yeah, yeah.
He said,
yeah.
Well, at least
Sherry's not running off.
She's not going to run off with the bloke
that
next door.
Brilliant.
And that dealt with the entire question in just one sentence, and it, as you say, you know, it was very, very effective.
It was very well judged, and he used it, I mean, and Cameron did that as a political device, as Blair did then, and I thought Ed Miliband's gags felt a bit more like just stand-up night, and it was, you know, to the joke about the deviated septum and Ed's nose day, and so he was actually deflating himself, and I wasn't sure that he'd been inflated enough at the beginning of his speech to actually warrant that deflation, and I wondered whether he could have had some gags in there about other people instead, about, I don't know, about Blair and Brown. I thought those self-deprecating gags, they work brilliantly if you're someone like Obama, who's godlike, but if you're Ed Miliband,
What about Clegg?
Clegg's were...
I remember any.
No.
Clegg's were a bit more gallows humour, as I remember, and it was that one about they didn't like us much in opposition. Now they like us even less. They like us even less now we're in government.
And I thought that was just no more than the truth. Was this a joke?
It did generate a laugh, though. But maybe just because they were desperate for a laugh.
It is funny how some politicians can do it and some can't, though. I mean, classically, Mrs. Thatcher could never deliver a joke, and she struggled to understand the
joke. She didn't understand the ladies not for turning. She didn't know what it came from. She didn't know what it referred to. It was written by a playwright for her, and she absolutely didn't get it. And most of her jokes.
And a dead parrot thing about the Lib Dems. She didn't get
the mummy as well, did she? The mummy one.
And she didn't. And she didn't get the. You know, every prime minister needs a willy.
Yeah, no, she had no idea what the joke was without having, apparently,
the slightest clue.
Some really rude jokes.
Well, thank you very much to Martin, Polly and Simon. Because we've promised it, we'll now treat you to the loudest laughs of all of this year's conference season, which we're going to hear just before we fade out.
It was that woman who made a fantastic speech in Hackney and scared them all off. Is she here? Pauline. I don't know where she is. She was here last night. It was the restaurant workers who fought them off with rolling pins and saucepans. It was the Broom Brigade of Clapham that stood up for London. That's right. Clapham. Clapham is right. But the reality is there was virtually only one thing safer than a bike hire stand in London, and that was, of course, a bookshop during the Regency.
Last year, Ed Balls and I were rivals. This year, we were united up front, and he must be doing a good job, because if you've seen the photos, there was certainly no squeezed middle.
Ooh.
I bet I'll make any spending commitments now, had I?
And here at this conference, we've been recording audiobooks for the blind. Now, I looked very carefully at the books that my colleagues chose. George knew exactly what he wanted. He went straight for the man who would be king. So, I'm afraid Boris missed out. Instead, he chose the joy of cycling.
And of course, one other big event happened in my life this year. The one the media was most interested in. My nose job. July 27th. They even gave it a name, Ed Noseday.
And let's face it, conference, barely a day goes by without yet another missive from Mr. Pickles to local councils. Frankly, it would take more than a weekly bin collection to get rid of his rubbish.
Conference, in just over a year, Jeremy Hunt, I did say Hunt, has gone from rising star to the long list of wannabe former potential prime ministers.
Banks operate a bit like a man who either wears his trousers round his chest, stifling breathing, which is what they do at the moment, or round their ankles, exposing their assets.
I thought I wouldn't keep you for too long tonight because I want to get back to my hotel room to watch Strictly. Do you watch it? Of course you do. I heard, though, that they've got Peter Hain booked for the next series. He's doing the tango. Or has he been tangoed?
Oh, well, we'll leave you ho-ho-hoing with Sarah Tether there. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.